Georgie Crawford. You're listening to the Goat Glow podcast. Over the last year, through my treatment for breast cancer, I've realised the importance of self-care. Whether it's a trip to the gym, a checkup with your GP, or even a 5-minute meditation, the time has come for us to put ourselves higher on our own to-do list. Over the next few weeks, I'll be speaking to people who inspire me and people who I believe you, the listener, will benefit greatly by listening to. Delighted to be joined today by Alison Canavan, UCLA trained mindfulness facilitator.
That's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it?
When you say it out loud, it is. Alison, thank you so much for being here today. I am so excited for our conversation because I think my listeners are going to love you.
I was so excited when you reached out because your name has been coming up so much. And it's like Georgie Crawford. And it's just in, it's everywhere. And it's funny because my sister this morning rang me and she goes, what are you doing today? I said, I'm going in to do a podcast, Georgie Crawford. Oh my gosh, I love her. And I'm like, it's really interesting until you bring up someone's name. Do you know what I mean? You don't really know. So she says, oh yeah, I listen to her podcast and everything. So you're doing great work. So thank you.
And you know, my podcast is nothing without my guests. So I'm so grateful to everyone for all the support. Tell us a little bit about your life so far. Self-care and wellness is a huge part of your everyday now. But what got you to this point?
Yeah, so it's quite a complex journey and definitely not a straight line. When I was 15, I was put into a competition by my mom for modelling and her friend Cindy. And my mom actually wasn't one of those kind of pushy stage moms or anything. It was her friend Cindy who was saying to her, you know, oh, everybody's saying Alison's so tall and she should be a model. And you know, she knew Elaine, who used to own the agency in Dublin at the time. And the first thing I heard of it was that I was in the final. I was like, I didn't even know I was in a competition. Now I'm in the final. And I went over to the RDS and it was a huge big stage. It was called Head to Toe. It was before Off the Rails. So it was about 26 years ago now. And it was this massive big catwalk. And I just remember being terrified. And there was models at the time like Amanda Byram, I remember, Jill Goldthorpe, you know, Sonia, Sheila Eustace, Laura Birmingham, Mary Staunton, all of these girls, Karen, fantastic. We had such an amazing kind of group of Irish models at the time. And I remember walking down and just being so shy and insecure. And then I won the Head to Toe. And then I went over to London. And then I represented Ireland in the Ford Supermodel of the World competition when I was 16.
Wow.
And I came ninth in that and went straight to Paris, to Ford in Paris. And it kind of all took off from there. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do. Like as a child, I was like, I want to be a doctor. I want to heal people. I want to help people. And I think that kind of healing, helping people was always in me from a very young age. And my auntie used to have nursing homes. And I used to spend so much time in those nursing homes. And I adored being around older people. And I just loved what I used to learn. I just used to feel so content. So even when I left school, I went straight to London and I went and I moved in with Sadie and Paddy. And there was a nursing home on the corner that she had. And I used to go up every day and sit and they were great characters and get to know them. And I kind of was in the space of, okay, this opportunity is here. Like I wasn't crazy about modelling. I loved the travel. I loved meeting new people. I'm definitely a people person. But the industry as such wasn't something that I absolutely adored doing. I struggled very early on with my mood.
Okay.
Like from a very young age. And it was kind of a running joke in my house at home. You know, I'm one of five girls. And when you're one of five girls, there's a lot of banter and, you know, different energies going on in the house. And I'd wake up in the morning and they'd go, oh, I suppose you're in a bad mood today again, Alison. And I'd be like, no, I'm not actually in a bad mood. But then I'm like, but I am now because you said it. But what I realized is that I always kind of felt it was very difficult to get going in the morning. But I just presumed everybody felt that way. I just thought that was part of being a human being. Now, the way I live and the way I feel, I know that that's not the way it should be. And I just kind of took that for granted. And from a very early age, when I presented with anything, fear of flying, not being able to sleep, which I now kind of think maybe it was just loneliness, traveling on my own, you know, all of these different things. And I was given medication from a really early age and then antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication. And nobody ever said to me along the journey that, you know, how I was living and how I was showing up and the habits that I had every day had something to do with how I was feeling. You know, nobody ever made those connections for me. So I used to present to therapists and doctors and anybody really to fix me. Like it was kind of like going to offices and going, I need you to fix me. Because that's what we're taught. We're taught that other people will fix us and that we have no power in how we feel or how we show up in life. And I used alcohol super early on. I mean, everybody always says, oh, is it when you got into the modeling industry that you really started drinking? And I was like, no, it was in Dublin with my friends. You know, it was, that's when it began. It didn't begin in the modeling industry. It began at home. But I was the person who, first of all, I got great relief from it. It was kind of like, wow, this takes me out of myself. But from a very early age, I always took it too far. Like I never had any kind of boundaries, you know, like I was out with the friend, I would be out with friends. And like even when you were super young and you'd rob drink from your house, you know, I'd be the person that would have to drink it all or go that step further. Whereas my friends around me would have off buttons.
And why did you do that?
Because I was just, it was the first time I felt relief from the feelings of heaviness, from the anxiety, from the sadness. So I was like, oh, wow, this helps to make me feel better. So what I did for years then is it was amazing. You know, you go partying for years. I got into an industry where you can party every day of the week. And we had such fun and it was incredible. So there were times that were fun, but eventually that fun catches up in you. You know, you can't live like that forever and not feel the effects of it. So I needed the highs to be higher. And because of the highs needed to be higher, the lows were lower. Like, we talk about anxiety in Ireland at the moment and we can't have that conversation without looking at our problem with alcohol, you know, in young people, because if you suffer from anxiety or depression and you're drinking, you're making it worse.
And was there more good times than bad times?
Oh, definitely in the early years. Absolutely. Like I was great fun to have at a party, you know, like everybody knew me as Party Alley. But the problem with that was that it kind of became my identity. And I identified with that. Like it was like, yeah, invite Alison. She's great fun. You know, she'll stay out all night. And there was definitely amazing times during my career, but it started to catch up with me. And I just didn't understand my depression. I didn't understand my anxiety. I didn't understand the connection that how I was living, the habits I had every day were affecting how I was feeling. There was no connection there. And I was always interested in meditation, which is really interesting because there was like a parallel life going on. And I had wonderful kind of meditation teachers in my mid-20s in New York. There was a guy called Cadden Mortem. He was amazing. And I remember the first session I ever went with him. I just remember, first of all, sitting there going, I can't believe everyone's doing this. You know, I had my eyes closed and I was thinking, I can hear my stomach. I can hear my thoughts. Can everybody else hear my thoughts? I mean, they seem really loud. I mean, it's, and I kept kind of opening my eyes, looking at everyone going, I can't believe all these people are doing this and keeping their eyes closed. And it was really uncomfortable in the beginning. But when he talked, he used to make sense of life in New York. And I always kind of thought, wow, anybody that can help make sense of life in New York is incredible. He's a wonderful teacher and I did lots of retreats with him. But there was still a disconnect with how I was showing up every day and how I was trying to, quote unquote, fix it, you know. So I would go on these retreats and then think that the retreat would fix me and then I'd go back to my old life in the city.
And when you were on these retreats, were you like, that's it, everything is going to change? Or were
Absolutely.
You like, this is
yeah.
fine for a week?
Yeah. No, I mean, I would be like, that's it. After this weekend, this retreat, you know, I'm going to go back and things are going to be different. But I suppose my life was so out of the ordinary. You know, I started modeling at 15. I was in Paris. I lived on Central Park West. Like I had an amazing life in New York, but I didn't have a life that would support me from stepping out of the party scene. And that was the problem. You know, I didn't have a support structure in my everyday life because like there would be 50 phone calls in the evening going, hey, Ali, there's this amazing party going on, or there's this launch, or you're invited to this and come along. And there were loads of periods in New York where myself and a few other models went to AA and we really tried and we would go to events together and then somebody would fall off the wagon and then somebody else would. And so, you know, it's a fast paced, fast moving city, you know, so if you're in any way disconnected from yourself, you're going to get disconnected even further.
And did you feel like it was serious at the time or would you kind of laugh, oh, she's fallen off the wagon, we didn't keep
no,
it up?
No, nobody ever would laugh. Like we would definitely try and support each other. Like we knew within the industry that there was people that had a lot right. of issues around this space. So you would always try and kind of respect, you know, the fact that if someone was trying to get clean and sober or work in themselves, you know, that you would try and support them. But Unfortunately, in those days, there was more people doing it than not doing it. You know, it's kind of like coming home to Ireland and getting sober here. Yeah, it's a pretty lonely place to be, you know. But I mean, the industry taught me resilience. Like my time in America, I think, prepared me for coming home to Ireland and becoming a single mom, because the Americans have a can-do attitude. And if it's the one thing I picked up, and I still work there a lot, I always picked up that I can do anything, you know, that kind of sense of community and collaborative kind of nature. Like if I remember being at brunch in New York, and if you said to the girls or guys, you know, I have this idea, and they're like, okay, how can we all make that idea come to life for you?
That's amazing.
And even in LA, I just got back from LA 2 weeks ago, and I went to an Oscars gifting party, and that's not the world I'm in anymore. And I actually found it really uncomfortable. I was like, I can't believe this used to be my world. And I went with my friend Nicole. She's amazing. We've been friends since our New York days, and I always stay with her. And I was talking to a few women that she introduced me to, and we were just chatting about what I do now and everything. And I came home, and the day after I came home, one woman emailed me and she goes, you mentioned this to me when we met that day, and here's somebody in New York who I rang and they said they can help you. The next day I got another email and she was like, I was thinking about what you were saying and I think that you should bring this to LA and here's how we can help you. And I'm like, I never asked them for anything, but they wanted to help. And she was like, best of luck with everything now. I hope it all goes well. And I'm just like, wow, the power of human beings helping each other never ceases to amaze me.
So what was the point then where everything changed for you? Can you remember it?
I think it was gradual, even though it seems like it was quite dramatic. It was gradual. So all my time in New York, I was big into yoga, Pilates, you know, so I was always looking. I was always a spiritual soul seeker. Like I'm a deeply spiritual person. So the meditation kept consistently and constantly pulling me back. So I've been doing meditation since my 20s, and it's something that I never left. So when I came home and it was, surprise, you're pregnant, after breaking up with my boyfriend, I really sat into my practice. Like I went to the Kadampa Buddha Center here that's just down the road. I even took my mum with me so she could understand kind of why I do the practice. And I really kind of leaned in to the spiritual side of us, which some people are uncomfortable with the word spiritual, but I think it's just leaning into our instincts. And I think as women, the world doesn't support us working on ourselves. And I think a lot of the time when we feel like there's something off, you know, when people always say to us, oh, women are crazy, women are this. I'm like, I actually don't think they are. I think that's just our body, mind and spirit telling us that something's off, you know, and we just have to label it now, you know, when we don't kind of stay in our window of tolerance or stay in this kind of space that's safe for us and for everyone else around us, well, then we're deemed mad, you know, or then we have to medicate it or then we have to do something. And I'm like, how about just kind of sitting with that? And trying to honor that and trying to own that, because maybe it's just our emotions trying to tell us something. So my journey into pregnancy was like at 32, terrifying because it was a surprise. And I'm like, hold on a second, I'm supposed to be married with kids. You know, like this is not supposed to, the way it's supposed to happen. So there was so many like shifts in paradigms of my own mental constraints that I had to break through. And my own judgments that I had no idea I had. And I was like,
judgments on yourself?
Judgments on how I was reared, like single mothers. You know, I never thought about single moms because I quite frankly, I just didn't know very many. You know, there was no single moms in my family. And I realized very quickly that I must have had an inner judgment about single moms, because otherwise, why was I struggling so bad? Why was I struggling so bad with the idea of becoming a single mom if I didn't have a judgment about it? And that's what I found very interesting. And I think a lot of our judgments are subconscious and they're blind spots. They're things that we don't even know are there until they crop up in our life. It's interesting and it's difficult when you're working on yourself, because sometimes you have to look at the deeply uncomfortable parts of yourself to truly heal. And that's what I wasn't getting through the years. So when I was being medicated, it was striving for this perfection, good girl, good emotions, and anything else we had to get rid of, you know. And it's like we're not comfortable with being a fully rounded human being in the world. You know, we've got a happiness epidemic where everyone's trying to be happy all the time. And we've also got gross misconceptions about the world of meditation and mindfulness. Like mindfulness is about acceptance. It's not about clearing your mind or clearing your thoughts. It's about accepting who and where you are in this moment.
I think we've gone so far with mindfulness and meditation. And like you say, everyone's trying to do your best. But let's bring it back to what is mindfulness? Yeah. Because we've gone so far down the road, many people may be afraid to put up their hand and say, actually, I don't have a clue what this is.
And it's interesting because it's a term, like so many terms, that's so overused but misunderstood. And very simply, it's about being in the present moment with openness, curiosity, and a willingness to be with what is. Okay, so what does that mean? So a willingness to be with whatever is happening for you in the moment. So we spend our lives not present, not in this moment, thinking that when we're in the future or when something different would happen, when then we'd be happier. So very, very rarely are we ever here. And the future is happening right now. It's happening in this moment while we're having this conversation. Another key point about it is that we do that with non-judgment. So if a difficult or uncomfortable emotion is arising, we sit with it without judging it. And the most important part, which my gorgeous mentor said to me in UCLA early on, mindfulness not met with self-compassion causes anxiety. So have you ever read when, you know, in some of the magazines, somebody would say, oh, I went to try this meditation thing and I went on a 5-day retreat, having no previous experience of meditation, no previous experience of being silent with yourself. Of course, you're going to have anxiety. If you sat with yourself for 5 days in silence and you had never done it before, you are definitely going to be anxious, because let me tell you, a lot of stuff is going to come up for you that you're not comfortable with. But we have to meet that with kindness and self-compassion. And it's a really, really important part of the process, because if we can't do that, we are going to become anxious about where we are in the world. So I think with mindfulness, it's a practice. There's no goals. We're not getting anywhere. We're not going anywhere. It's not like if you do it for 3 months, you're going to feel a certain way, or if you do it for 10 years. A fabulous teacher, Matthew Brensilver, said to me once, he said, you know, day one of mindfulness, it was like a chaotic mad circus inside. And he goes, day 391, the same. Like, he's one of the most beautiful teachers in the world. And he said there was absolutely no promise of all of these things that people think are going to happen. But there's something that draws you in. There's something inside of us. There's some innate part of us, like our inner guidance system, our wisdom, our essence, that knows that when we connect with that, something special happens.
So for anybody listening and they want to practice mindfulness, what do you recommend they do?
I would recommend finding a teacher, because what we have at the moment is an epidemic of so many people teaching mindfulness who are not qualified.
Okay.
So we have a big, like, so what you need to be able to do is support whoever's in your class with whatever's happening for them to help guide them through the difficulties. So that can be done online. You know, I have a group where I do my live meditations in my Minding members group. I do a meditation every week, and you can ask me and have access to me all the time as a coach, as a meditation teacher. And I think that's really important, because I think mindfulness can be done in so many different ways. We have a formal sitting, which is, you know, the Google kind of version of mindfulness, where you're sitting cross-legged, which you don't have to do. So that's called a formal practice, where you actually sit. And then you have lots of informal practices, which you can stand in the queue in the bank or in the supermarket and bring your attention down to your feet and ground yourself into your body and take a few deep breaths. There's so many ways to bring mindfulness into your experience. But what we're doing is training ourselves into awareness. We're so busy. We're being pulled in 50,000 directions all the time. And science is now proving to us that we actually can't multitask like we've been led to believe. We're far better off focusing on one thing at a time. When I'm in LA, I'm always fascinated, and people fascinate me, and I love people. And I think the potential for human beings is just simply incredible. And so many of my friends who are top CEOs in LA, when I meet them, give you their full undivided attention with no phone on the table. And they probably achieve more than most people I know. And this fascinated me recently. And I started looking at the research around this, and an amazing teacher, Frank Ostasteki, he's wonderful, and he's much older. He's a Buddhist teacher. And I was doing a conference a few years ago called the Mindful Life Conference in Washington. I was speaking. He was the opening speaker. I will never forget his talk. He has worked with people at end of life care. So he was working during the time of the AIDS epidemic and everything. And he's an extraordinary man. And I remember having to go up to my room afterwards, because he opened my heart in such a way that I'd never. If we want to talk about compassion, he opened this part of me, and I actually went up to my room and sobbed for about half an hour, and I had to go down and do a talk. I was like, and a friend of mine was with me at the time, and she's like, and I said, it was a sense of release. It was a sense of relief. But he was such an extraordinary human being around this space. And what he teaches people is that we can have moments of rest any time. Now, this to me was a revolutionary thought, okay? Mm. Because we always think that we have to have times of rest in the evening or outside of work or when we're not with people. But he's like, even if you're in a meeting at work, you can have a moment of rest in that meeting. And when I was listening to it first, I was like, okay, there's something in me that's fighting with this right now, but I always look at that as an opportunity for growth, you know? And what I have learned from listening to him and practicing the work that he teaches is that he's absolutely right. So, you know, we have a lot of conversations these days with work-life balance and we separate different parts of ourselves. But the truth is that it's how you show up in all of your 24 hours that dictates and determines how you feel.
And what did he say then?
So he was saying like there's opportunities for rest all the time. So if you're having a conversation with a friend, the opportunity to be present with that friend, put your phone down in your handbag, you know, it's the presence gives you the opportunity for rest. So rest doesn't have to be lying down. You know, we can take a moment, go outside, look at the sky, take a deep breath. So our brain actually needs, neuroscientists have found that our brain needs rest during the day as well in order for us to have good sleep at night. So there's brilliant research around this at the moment. So having like every 90 minutes, we know that our sleep cycle is 90 minutes long. It goes in 90 minutes, 90 minutes. But they're now saying that that's the same for during the day as well. And how you can get that in is by just going outside, having, you know, a look up at the sky, going and making yourself a cup of coffee, just taking a break of some shape or form every 90 minutes, standing up, stretching. There's so many ways to do it. But what that does is give your brain the chance to kind of reset so that you can store memories, that you can function better, that you can be actually more creative. A brilliant young guy, I was so happy for this question a few weeks ago. I was doing a talk and a young guy asked me, which was a phenomenal question. So he was very driven, very into fitness, very into everything. And he said, okay, so I start practicing mindfulness and I start doing what you say and I become comfortable with who I am at the moment and I accept who I am. Where's my drive gone? And I was like, that's a brilliant question. Mm. And thank you for asking it, because that's what our rational mind would lead us to believe, that if we accept who we are in this moment, why would we want to be better? Why would we want to push ourselves? Why would we want to have goals? The truth of the matter is, when we're constantly striving for goals in the future, we're doing it from a stress state. We're not doing it from a state of presence. So if you bring yourself into a state of presence, you're actually more creative, mm-hmm. you're more driven, and you're more focused. So it's actually the opposite to what we believe and what we think. It's very powerful.
I'm going through that now that you say it, like myself at the moment. So I'm in counselling and I feel like I'm getting over the cancer and there's so much fear with that because I don't want to forget it and I don't want to get complacent. And I say to my counsellor, like, I'm afraid to get too far from it because I'm scared that I won't have the drive to eat well every day and exercise well if I forget.
But the thing is that if you integrate it and accept it as a part of your journey and what's happened to you, you will never forget. Because it's part of you. It's part of your cellular memory. So very often we're told that we need to leave things behind us, especially uncomfortable and difficult things that have happened to us. So people who experience trauma. And Gabor Mate is one of my favorite teachers in this space because he teaches us, and I just did more trauma training in the States, and I'm fascinated by the world of trauma because I think we're all traumatized to a degree. You know, I think if we live in the modern world, we've experienced some form of trauma. But what we need to do is look at those parts of our journey and integrate them and welcome them and say, I see you. I see what you've been through. I love you. And now I'm going to integrate you as part of who I am. And you will always be there and I'll always mind you. Does that make sense? So I'm trained in compassionate inquiry, which he does. And it's getting people to go back and look at the parts of themselves that they don't want to be, you know. So when I was going into recovery, there was times that were difficult, times I didn't treat people very well. I didn't want to go back there because it's not a very nice place to be, you know. But going back there, you don't have to relive it. But going back and looking at it and accepting it, you know, or talking to the depressed part of yourself and integrating it, I don't think you will ever forget that, because that has determined the person you are sitting here today. It has shaped you to do this podcast. It has woken up an aspect of you who wants to go out and share that experience with the world and change lives. So once we let go of the fear around this, because we live in a world of fear, you know, we live in a world that we are being fed fear all the time. But if we actually settle and we open our heart and we move into our heart and stop living in a rational mind, we actually become far more powerful. And our power is not the power that we've been taught in the Western world. So we've been taught that power is when we have more, when we do more, when we're rich. Our power lies in connecting to our true inner being. That's where our power lies. Our power lies in connecting to our purpose. And that's what you've done. So you're already in your power. So you don't have anything to fear because you've already connected to that. That's the gift that cancer brought you.
Cancer has done so much for me. And, you know, reading Oprah's book, What I Know For Sure. Mm. And I read a chapter and she spoke about acceptance and acknowledgement. And that changed my relationship with cancer.
Yeah.
And I was so lucky to survive it. You know, I feel so grateful every day. And it's funny now when I sit on the couch with my baby and I hug her, I don't feel scared anymore. Yeah. I felt scared for a full year. And every time I hugged her, I thought about her wedding, her first day at school, what was going to happen to me next year. Now when I hug her, I'm in the moment. Yeah. And I just think about how much I love her. And it's really amazing to have come that far.
And it's so beautiful to get to that place in life where there is so much to be grateful for. Like, those moments are the magic. Like, when we talk about miracles, we think that miracles are these big, huge things that happen. Miracles are the small little things every day, like sitting on the couch with your daughter, having the moment to hug her. Like, James was asleep last night and he's eight and we've finally gotten him into his own bed all the time, which is amazing. And I went up and I was just sitting looking at him and I gave him a kiss and I'm like, this is not going to last forever. Like, this moment with him, this time where he's just like, thinks I'm like the most amazing thing in the world. But sinking into gratitude, coming through adversity, like coming out of addiction, there is not a day. And actually, when you're saying that, there was a fear in me that who am I without depression, anxiety and addictions? Like, who am I? I don't know. I've never spent time with the other person because I've always been high, quite frankly, for 20 years. You know, so even when you're, I used to say, even when you were sober, you were still a bit high if you were out the night before. Like, if you were out drinking till 2 a.m, you're still kind of not right the next day. And that's a very difficult thing, A, to say out loud, because immediately if I heard someone saying that, my judgmental mind would go, oh, Jesus, what a mess. But quite frankly, that was the truth of it. You know, it was like you meet people for lunch in London, you'd start with a glass of wine. And if we didn't have anything to do in the afternoon, that would keep going. And that's the way everybody's life was. Who was I without that? Would people like me? Would people accept me? You know, it's difficult to move out of that because we get defined by the story we tell ourselves and the story other people tell us as well. And to change that story is hard.
What do you say to people who want to change but haven't had a moment? They haven't had an addiction. They haven't had cancer. There is nothing major happening in their lives to make them change.
So I think if you want to change, you are having a moment. There is something in your life that is causing you to want to make that shift and to want to wake up, you know, and it is about being more conscious and aware. And I think we're at a time where consciousness is shifting. We are kind of all trying to wake up. We're understanding the power of human connection. One of the most powerful things, it was funny because in UCLA a few weeks ago, there was lots of different neuroscientists and they were, you know, doing all their research that they're doing the world of mindfulness and trauma and everything. And it's funny to see everybody disagree on different things. And the one thing I found in all my years of study, and I've 8 years studying since James was born, the only thing that every single scientist I've ever come across can agree on is the power of human connection and community. And even the Harvard study, which is in its 82nd year now, says year on year that the people that live the longest and are the happiest are the people with real human connections and relationships. The Blue Zones, I don't know if you've seen that. There's a guy who's written The Blue Zones. It's fabulous. And he's gone into pretty much every country in the world and looked at people's diets, lifestyles, culture, community. And again, he says people that are happiest, that live the longest, are the people that have good quality relationships. You don't have to have very many, but the relationships have to be meaningful. And that brings us right back again to being a human being. being a human being and what helps us heal. And as women, I think we're so powerful for each other. Like, as women, to support each other, that female, divine, feminine energy, that intuitive energy that we have. Like, when we talk about equality today, it's like, I'm so over the word equality, because we're not equal. We're different. Women are a completely different species to men. Like, we're just different. And we need to acknowledge our differences as well in this world. Women are incredibly intuitive. We are mothers. Like, if we're looking at animals in the wild, it's the female of the animals that will sense danger coming from far away because she's trying to protect her young. The males don't have that same sense of danger. And it's the same for us as human beings. So I think what we need to come back to and what we've lost is the power of community, of real relationships in our life. And if we really want to heal, we're not going to heal in isolation. We're going to heal as a collective, you know. And in Ireland, we are one of the most ancient, sacred cultures on earth. Just look at some of our, like the Hill of Tara, everything's like all of the most amazing places that we have in Ireland on such a small island. We've ancient Druid culture, shamans, everything. We're deeply, deeply spiritual people. And what I always say to people is, we're not trying to learn anything. We're trying to remember who we are because we all have it inside of us. We're just trying to remember. And when we go to that place, it's a very powerful place to be. You know, when we understand that just by connecting with each other and connecting with other women, the potential for us as human beings grows hugely.
It's funny, when I look back now at my cancer journey, it was, you know, it started 18 months ago. But the standout moments are my moments of human connection. Yeah, so when a friend knocked on the door or left something on my doorstep or somebody sent me a card... That's what it is. They're the highlights. That's I see that more than I see my bald head in my memory.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine, Claire Solon, arrived on my doorstep after 4 years and handed me Oprah's book, which in turn changed my relationship with cancer. So is your advice to reach out? Like, my friend is going through something at the moment, and yesterday, the old me wouldn't have called her because I'd say, oh, just leave her. Yeah. She needs a bit of space.
Yeah.
But I picked up the phone yesterday and called. Even if I was an inconvenience, I just wanted her to know I was thinking of her. So is that what you mean, to reach out?
Yeah, it means reach out more. You know, it's we're not making time for what's important because we have this busyness epidemic going on, you know, and we've all kind of fallen for the busyness epidemic, you know. I'm the busiest person in the world, which means I'm really important and that my life must be going great and I must be successful in some ways. And I'm like, there is no race, you know, and what I've realized within myself is, for me to combat stress and anxiety, I have to understand that the busyness only exists inside of me, you know? And when I'm not in that rat race, I'm actually more productive. I get more done. I have better quality of life. But making time, I always say, it's not about learning to say no is really important. But what are you not saying yes to? Are you not saying yes to that dinner that you were supposed to have with your girlfriends? Are you not saying yes to that class that you wanted to do on a Saturday morning? And very often what we're not saying yes to is more important, because the things that we're not saying yes to are the things that nurture and nourish us as human beings.
And why are we so far down our own to-do lists as women?
I think the modern world has just become so dependent on external materialistic factors. You know, like our worth has been defined of what we own, who we become, you know, how we show up in the world. And we've lost that connection with ourselves. I mean, look, it's evident all over the world. You know, the wellness epidemic isn't like an epidemic, it's like an explosion. It isn't there for no reason. People are struggling. People are sick. Like, if the emails I read every day from people with addictions, loneliness, moms at home who drink every night because they just don't know it's something they look forward to. Like, they might only be having one or two glasses of wine, but they're like, I know that that's my crutch. I know that that's almost like my friend. You know, I can't wait to get to 6 o'clock to have that glass of wine. And I wish I didn't feel that way. So when Dr. Gabor Maté always says, you know, ask not why the addiction, ask why the pain. And addiction is a sliding scale. You know, you can be on the lower end or the higher end, but we all struggle with addiction because we're all self-soothing a part of us that's in pain. And that part of us we're self-soothing is an unmet need inside of us. So instead of trying to constantly self-soothe with something external, we need to look at that and we need to sit with it. And that's where we circle back to mindfulness and ask ourselves, How am I feeling right now? Like, where is it? What is it inside of me that I'm not looking at? And that's a very powerful place to be. You also have to be incredibly vulnerable to do that, because you have to be willing to sit with whatever comes up for you and work through it. But you don't have to do it alone. Like, this Friday, I'm going for therapy. You know, I'm doing this work years and years and years, and I have a practice where I have clients every day that I coach and I work with, and I'm a meditation teacher. But some of the greatest teachers in the world have mentors and therapists. You know, that's part of being a human being. There's nobody alive on this planet today that has this all figured out, by the way. Like, you know, there's no big secret that someone's hanging on to. You know, the way I think Eckhart Tolle is just one of my favorite human beings on earth. And he just did a series with Oprah on his book, A New Earth. It was a 10-part series. And it was just truly wonderful for anyone who wants to listen. He's such a gift to the world. And Oprah, what I love about Oprah is that she comes at everything with a beginner's mind. So even though she is so wise and she knows so much, she always comes at everything with a beginner's mind. And it's beautiful. And she kept saying to Eckhart Tolle, and I think it was week 7 or something, she kept saying, people are quite frustrated with your answers, because what is his answer? Come back to the present moment. Come back to the present moment. And they're like, yeah, no, but I don't know if you heard my story. Like, my story was that this, this, and this. And he's like, yes, then come back to the present moment. And a really brilliant thing that he said as well. So a mum rang in and she was talking about her toddler having a tantrum. And she was like, I don't know what to do. And she was trying to also have a spiritual practice and all this type of stuff. So he said, well, what you do during that time is check in on yourself. So check your inner state. How are you? Because kids mirror our state. If we're stressed, they're stressed, you know. So, and he said, quite honestly, if that's the only thing you did for the next 18 years, that's your spiritual practice. It kind of releases us from this heavy to-do list, you know, of allocating time for everything. And that's the most important thing we can do. Check in with where we are, you know, and how we're showing up and how we're responding to things, because that's the only thing we can control. Like, through my years of addiction, I realized I can't change other people. I can't make people see the world the way I do, because that's not my job and it's not my place. All I can do is work on my world, my inner world. And it's that old saying of monkey see, monkey do. Like, when parents come to me and they say, I really want my kids to do this, I'm like, are you doing it? Because they're not going to do it if you're not doing it. So it's exactly the same, and it's powerful.
So for somebody who has suffered trauma and they live their life now in fear of something else going wrong, are you recommending that they sit at their desk or on their couch or wherever they are and say, everything in this moment is fine?
Yeah, no, I think with trauma is a whole different side. I think absolutely with trauma, you need to go and work with someone. I would always say that. Like, when I had trauma years ago, I went and worked with a trauma specialist. Some people believe that we have to go and relive our trauma to process it and get rid of it. I'm not one of those people that believe that. I think we have to acknowledge it and accept it and integrate it into part of who we are. I mean, Oprah Winfrey is one of the best people to talk about this. You know, she accepted the really dark stuff that happened to her when she was younger. And if she didn't accept it and integrate it as part of who she is, well, then she wouldn't be able to be the great teacher she is today. So I think for people with trauma, I would always say to people, go and be supported and don't try and do this on your own. Don't try and be a hero. You know, don't try to get through everything on your own. There's no problem with asking for help.
I think for a lot of people, they're like, I don't want to open this can of worms now. I'd prefer to just keep pushing it down.
Where do you think it goes? Pushing it down further, further, further. Sitting in your body. It's being stored in your body and it's causing a dis-ease in some form. Might take
five. Does that make you sick?
Exactly. It's a dis-ease with yourself, and it presents as either a physical illness or a mental illness, but it doesn't go anywhere. So you have to deal with it in some shape or form. And if you don't willingly deal with it now, something will happen later on that'll force you to deal with it. So I always kind of say, it's the analogy as if I had a bottle of Coke here and I was shaking it and I shook it a little bit and took the top off and some of it would spurt out because I'd just shaken it a little bit. If it was shaken really vigorously for years until the point where it exploded and the cap came off, it's going to cause quite a mess. It's going to leave everything sticky and you're going to have to clean up that mess. So the reason I live the way I do now and the reason why I try to, you know, honor kind of what I'm going through and work through it is because I don't want that mess to build up again, because I know what it's like for the mess to build up. I know how hard it is, you mm-hmm. know, when you're at that point of trying to wean off medication, you know, go into recovery. So I've been there and I don't want to go back. So for me, it's kind of, I say to people that nothing ever goes away. You know, it doesn't go away. Just because we push it down into our body, it still sits in our body and it's causing us emotional pain, you know. And a lot of people don't understand why they have all these emotions all the time. And quite frankly, emotions are simply energy. They're energy in motion. That's where the word comes from, energy in motion. They don't really want to sit there. But if you don't acknowledge them and look at them and give them the time and space they need, they are going to sit there and they're not going to go anywhere and they get stuck in our body. So that's why beautiful practices like yoga and Pilates and exercise and dancing, all of these things move our energy through our body. And if they're moving our energy through our body, we're moving our emotions through our body. So if I'm in my office and I feel frustrated and I'm writing and I just feel this kind of, I always call it my inner highway of stress, you know, it's kind of the middle mm-hmm. strip of your body is the inner highway of stress. And if I feel that starting to light up, I have a disco. Like people think I'm mad. Yeah, I do. Yeah, all the time. And I do it with James as well, because like James said to me this morning when I was like, do this, do that, he would say to me now, do you want to have a disco? And I'm like, no, I'm fine. I don't want to have a disco. But it's really interesting because movement is something that's so powerful. Once we move our body, we move our energy. And if you have a child in the morning, and try this, you know the way sometimes children wake up and they're just a little bit groggy and difficult to get going, turn on music, get them moving, and you will almost immediately see their state change.
That is such a good tip. I danced through chemotherapy. I did a battle with the stars with Breast Cancer Ireland.
Fab.
And it was so lovely. I'm back again this year. And every Monday night I go out and I do the quick step for an hour.
Wow.
And it brings pure joy to my life. Yeah. I can't.
So there you go.
And I was, you know, I always say it, not that type of person before I got sick. I'd be mortified to get up and dance. But I hear you on that. And
isn't it incredible?
So, yeah. And my sister-in-law, Kira, she was saying, you know, when this is over, maybe you should start Zumba or something that just makes you happy and go to the gym and just move your body, because it's so true what
you
say.
So powerful.
I want to leave the listeners with three transformation tips. Now, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but you know, three little things people could do to just start the change.
Kindness. Kindness is huge.
Like, to yourself.
To yourself and to other people.
Okay.
If you can leave a legacy of kindness behind you, it would be the greatest gift you ever left to mankind. And kindness is contagious and it creates like an energetic effect out into the world. Like, it's exactly what we were talking about earlier, where Maya Angelou always says, you will always remember how people made you feel. My dad's 20 years passed away this year, and I still meet people walking down the road who stop me to tell me how kind he was to them. And that, to me, is such a powerful thing to have left an imprint of that in the world. And kindness leaves an imprint on our hearts. So to try and move that, like what I always say to people, if you want to transform your life, keep it simple and keep it real. You know, there's no great big secret out there. It's just about kind of showing up with honesty, with integrity, being kind, being a human being in a world that's very difficult, and understanding that the person that you're talking to, or that's difficult sometimes, you have no idea what's going on with them. Like, very often we judge people so harshly and then months later we find out what was really happening at the time, you know? So try and have some compassion for yourself and for other people. And I think if people can just do that, human beings would be in a very different space.
How can people find you?
AlisonCanavan.com.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Good Glow podcast. Please subscribe so you can be the first to hear about new episodes. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review. You can check out thegoodglow.ie for more on my story and follow me on Instagram @GeorgieJCrawford.